I was on a trip to the States to visit my parents. I asked Deb O'Tone if he would be willing to fund a flight from New York up to Montreal so that I could meet this woman. I knew he wasn't really interested in the 20th century, but more in his ancestors who were great scholars. Deb O'Tone wrote this in the Mishneh Torah, this Kesef Mishneh and Lechem Mishneh. Lechem Mishneh was written by one of his ancestors. That's what more interested him. In those days, this will date me, it was only $100 round trip to Montreal from New York. I think about that now and I'm amazed. And so he said, okay. And I flew up and met this woman who actually had her friend with her, who was her translator and whatnot, and we chatted. And while we're talking about all the Deb O'Tones, and I recorded her, at the end of the conversation, she asked me where I was teaching, what I was teaching. At that point, I was teaching at Ben-Gurion University in the Negev, in the Center for Sephardic Studies, and I was teaching a course on the Sephardim and the Holocaust. And she said, what? And I said, yes, and of course, I'm teaching about Greece and Bulgaria and Yugoslavia and whatnot. And then she said, I wrote poems about my experience during the Holocaust, my experience in the 20th century. Would you like a copy? And hands me 200 pages in Ladino. And I looked at it and I said, sure. Not knowing what I was going to do with it, I was actually just about to start working on my first book on crypto-Jewish women, and this was not quite the same. But I took it with me and thought, what am I going to do with this? If I give it to Yad Vashem, they won't know what to do with it. They don't have many people who deal with Sephardim, Ladino, and so on and so forth. So I basically felt guilty about it, because at that time I went off to the States on a postdoc, and I was working on my book and for a couple of years. And then when I came back, there was a one-day conference at Yad Vashem, and it was on the Jews of Greece. So I said, let me go, and I met my friend Moshe Shaul, who used to run the Ladino the radio program here and taught with me at Ben-Gurion, and I told him what I had, and he said, here. The fellow Shmuel Raphael, who teaches at Bar Ilan, deals with poetry and the Holocaust. Tell him. I tell him, and he was too hyped up from his talk, so nothing went in. About a week later, he calls up and he says, what did you say you have? A woman writing poetry who survived from Salonika in Ladino? Oh, my God. His father was from Salonika. And I then gave him some of the poems to look at. My husband said, don't you give him anything. And I said, you know, well, he's sort of a landsman. You know, and the two of us started working on some of the poems. We did some, he talked about her as a poet. I started translating some of the poems then for a conference into Hebrew. And basically, I spent the next 10 years translating the poems little by little. Those of you don't know this, not really a good Ladino dictionary. When I first started, there was just the letter Gimel that was an attempt by Machon Ben Tzvi to do a dictionary, and after Gimel, they gave up. So I had Gimel there. Then I have a French Ladino dictionary, but it only deals with certain, you know, aspect of the language. By the time I had just about finished the book, a Hebrew Ladino dictionary came out from Male Adumim, from a center there. But basically, it was extremely, extremely difficult to translate it. She also had her own unusual spelling because she'd been educated in the Alliance, and French was her first language, or at least her spoken language was Ladino, but her first language of writing was French, and so she sort of francified her Ladino, and so the spelling was really odd. And I will tell you, I had some just amazing experiences thanks to her, because I went onto the Ladino website called Ladino Comunita, which is very formal. You have to introduce yourself and announce who you are, and everything has to be in perfect Ladino. So I sat with a Ladino speaker, and he said, why don't you go there? I said, because I learned Castellano, and it doesn't come as pure Ladino, and they'll throw me out, and then samichtet. You know, and I sent a message just saying, pick the hardest word and ask, does anybody know what it means? And I got two responses. One from Tel Aviv saying, I want to see these poems. And I said, when the book comes out. And another one from Istanbul, from a woman who not only told me what the word meant, but sent me a photograph of this. It was a word that had to do with embroidery, and sent me a photograph. And then I said to her, do you know English? And we got offline, and we became dear, dear friends and correspondents. And this marvelous woman, who was a story unto herself, and a movie could be made about her, she got me in. If she didn't know the word, she got in touch with all the Ladino speakers all over the world, and everybody just jumped in to try, so happy to try to figure out what these words were. And so there are a lot of annotated footnotes in my book, because I was very grateful. And she says, no, you can't send it off to the publisher without me checking everything. And so that was with the poems. Now, in the meantime, I wrote, I located her son, who was a psychoanalyst in Ottawa, and I told him that I was working on it, and he was thrilled, and his mother had passed away in the meantime. So I couldn't turn to her because her handwriting was really hard to read too, and there were times when I had eurekas because I would see how she would put two letters together and mix them up and what she really meant to say. I think that my favorite example is, I guess I could write, it was sort of humorous, but it looked like, sort of looked Japanese, like Harikara or something. And what it turns out is that after about a year, I realized that she didn't have the hey there. She looked like Arikara, and it was, the Spanish speakers don't have the H, so it was really supposed to be Hakshara. It was Hebrew, but she said Hakshara, and her C and her K and her H's all look the same. But in the context of what she was talking about, DP camps, I suddenly clicked and realized what it was. So this was it was very challenging to work with her poetry. And when I wrote to the son, he said, you know, my mother had a memoir. Would you like a copy? And I said, would I? He lost the Ladino version. He lost a lot of things. I love Eli. He is a great guy, but he lost the... There was a signet ring that was passed around generations, and in his son's bar mitzvah, he showed it to someone. They lost it in the grass. He lost the Ladino version, but he had the English translation that her friend had done, so I sort of worked with that. Buena Zarfati was born in 1916 in Salonika. She was from an eminent Jewish family of exiles from Spain who could trace their ancestry back to 1492. All of her writing was done after the war. She did not write anything during the war. I think when I give you some of the aspects of what she did, you'll see that she couldn't possibly have, didn't have the time and mindset to do it. But she did come from a family of, first of all, I should say, of women who were the most amazing embroiderers. She talks about this a number of times. After the war, she goes back to Salonika and she recognizes pieces of work, pocketbooks and valises and things that she and her mother and her grandmother and her aunt had done that had apparently been plundered from their home. And she actually walked up to someone and said, my mother made this, and chased this other girl to a house where she actually ended up finding her entire trousseau in the attic there. When they asked me about a cover for the book, I am very non-artistic, and I said, I really don't have any ideas. And they said, you know, don't you think about it. And I wrote to her son and said, Eli, your mother said she did all these embroideries. Did she have anything? Did she do anything? And then he proceeded to overload my computer with about 50 photographs of different embroideries that he had in his house. And I'm going to pass this around only because the Indiana University Press did the most in my opinion, gorgeous job. It almost looks 3D. It was my favorite embroidery, and you can almost feel it. I actually tried to find out what stitch it was. I got in touch with embroidery experts, and nobody could identify it. But it was a classic Sephardi stitch, and it just you don't have to read the book, just buy it because the cover's so gorgeous. You know, put it on your coffee table there. And I mean, Buena was she was an amazing person who had a major. Once she left her Sephardi world, she had a tremendously difficult time adjusting. Everywhere she went. I mean, when she left, she first came to Israel because she met. She was working with UNRWA, with the United Nations, restoration. She was working actually with the Machteret, with the underground, trying to get Jews to come to Palestine. But she was working as a dietitian, supposedly, and met an Ashkenazi Ukrainian whose family had all been killed in a pogrom in the Ukraine, except his brother and himself. They made it to Montreal, and then he made Aliyah and joined a kibbutz in Israel and took her, and it was a bad fit because she had stolen one of the most eligible bachelors, and she was a Sephardia. She didn't speak Hebrew very well. She spoke Spanish, Greek, French. I mean, all these languages that were totally useless on the kibbutz, and they were tremendously jealous of her. I mean, even in her memoir, she writes about how they asked her to sew something, and she did it like in 30 seconds, and the woman came in and said, somebody did this for you, and tore out all the stitches because simply didn't believe that, you know, this refugee could be so talented. And eventually she says, you've got to get out of here. I'm very unhappy here. And they make their way to Montreal. But also in Montreal, this was pre-North African immigration. There were not French speakers there. There were not Sephardim there. And she had a very, very difficult time as a Sephardia. There is the ancient Spanish and Portuguese synagogue in Montreal, but they were sort of like the DARs. You know, they were there for hundreds of years, and she came in with her experience and had many, many difficulties, which she writes about. And this is one of the problems I have with her memoir, is that her memoir is very bitter. She's angry, she's frustrated. She hasn't been, nobody know. Everybody just sees her some sort of, you know, weird old Sephardi lady. Nobody knew what she did during the war, which I'll talk about presently. They didn't respect the Sephardi heritage very much. When one of her colleagues came and was destitute, and she took him in and died, and she buried him, and she wanted to put the matzeva up after 30 days, they didn't want to let her because that's not their minhag, and they gave her a really, really rough time. Everything, and she writes about this a lot, and with sort of a lot of anger and a lot of frustration. As a matter of fact, her memoir was written in 1975, so she was 60, almost 60 years old, when she was she took a trip to Israel with her husband. Her husband had severe Parkinson's. She had one. Eli was the only surviving son. She lost her daughter at a 1 year old. So she had Parkinson's husband and healthy son. The memoirs are written in 75. She took the trip in 69. Okay, let me stand corrected. So she was 53 years old when she went. She went with the group of Jews from Montreal, Ashkenazim. The head of the group was a nasty, nasty woman who just was out to get her and to make her feel small. And it's very upsetting. In my book, I barely discuss it because I just didn't want to. I understood where her anger was coming from, but I wanted to present the more positive side of her life. And the memoir is 276 pages long. She had a lot to say. She did a lot in her life. And it's sort of based on reflections where she talks about the trip they took in Israel and things they did in Israel, and then which remind her of incidents that were in her previous life, in her previous experience. And I think that one of the things that happens is that she saved many children at during the war. And while she went around Israel, some of them recognized her. And it was just amazing, absolutely amazing. And then they got everybody together, all the children that she had saved, and came to honor her. And so you see this sort of thing of this dichotomy of being treated so poorly, even on the trip, of being told your husband's too slow, he can't walk fast enough, we won't wait for him, don't come here, don't do this, all the time telling her no, 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 no. And then she has this other life where she was, you know, a superstar, and sort of at least getting the validation from it, which she hadn't planned. She hadn't been in contact with any of them because she had placed them with family and then had left. I'm going to deal with everything.
Because
the bad stuff is why she wrote the memoir, and that was, and also when we're talking about, you know, about her looking inside herself, and this is what she. When she wrote her memoir, she was reflecting on her life and trying to weigh out the two. And it really incorporates both of her lives in this memoir, because you see them going back and forth and back and forth all the time. Her poetry was in two different collections, which I have in the book. One was 400 verses that dealt with life in Salonika in the 20th century, talking about every aspect, and she had numbered them, but just as they came to mind. I reorganized them all by theme, so that I put the ones that dealt with holidays together, the one that dealt with women's work, or ones that dealt with family issues, or ones that dealt with modernity. You know, I sort of organized them that way and wrote an introduction describing what happened in Salonika, and then you could see when you read her poems how she was incredibly accurate. She had a phenomenal memory. Even things that she talked about that on certain day, I check. As an historian, I checked everything, and she didn't miss it. She didn't miss a beat. And again, she was writing it many years later. She wrote it in Montreal. The second half of her poetry is 100 verses about the Nazi invasion and the Holocaust and her experience. I give you the very first. One of the very first verses: the Nazis invaded in April 9th, 1941. And number five that I have written here is about how she talked. It says, "A Salonika rumores que Hitler se va a morir, ma yo digo que pene y que no muera, que le venga un negro malo y que no escape más a él y su derredor mucha dolor de corazón. Espero que el Dios me va a sentir estas maldiciones que le eche. Vivamos a la salud de Besanchi." So there are rumors in Salonika that Hitler is going to die, but I say let him suffer and not die. May a great misfortune befall him, and may he and those around him no longer avoid great heartache. I hope that God is going to hear me and these curses that I have cast upon them. And then each of her verses is bebamos a la salud de, let us drink to the health of, and then she basically tried to memorialize people from the community in Salonika. In the book, I made a list of all the names of all the people that she had put in, and when I went to Canada last year, the book got the Canadian Jewish Book Award, and They had to dinner one woman who said that they found family members listed there and found out what happened to people during the Holocaust that they didn't know. So she did a great service also by this. It took a while till I figured out what she was doing. Sometimes she has little comments, but most of the time, Besanchi Davka was a journalist. So many of them I have no idea who they were, but Besanchi I happen to know was a journalist. And she wrote I tried to look for some of the comments that she made that showed her how she looked inside. And one of the things she wrote was disasters of the Second World War, Nazis, cruelty, starvation, persecution. I try my best always to forget, but in times of difficulty, you remember your life in the fullest detail. And that was sort of how she thought that when she was having a rough time coming to Israel, then that's why she had all these flashbacks of what had happened to her, what had happened earlier. And she also, she'd say, she knew she was a great singer. She knew the Sephardi tradition was her life. She knew more Sephardic songs and renditions of romanceros and different songs than almost anybody around. There's here at the Fonoteca at the Hebrew University, there are recordings of Buena Tzafati that were done before I had met her. A doctoral student in Canada who was a specialist in Judeo-Spanish and Ladino songs had heard about her, and half of her dissertation was on Buena Tzafati's songs and renditions that no one had ever heard of that she had, and they're thrilled to have it. So her attitude was really, when I'm really stressed out, I'll just sing. And I'll, the king and I, there. And again, she was, as she said, she was felt that there was, when she was being treated barely, she would either sing or she would just sort of be jarred by it and then move back and forth into life. It was really difficult going through and figuring out what to bring, what made sense. One of the stories that moved me was how her family dealt with a prisoner they had in their house. Now, why they had a prisoner in their house, we're talking about the history of the area is that Greece did not jump into World War II, but Italy, Mussolini decided on his own that he was going to take Albania and Italy, Albania and Greece. He didn't tell Hitler. The Greek army went to Albania, including Buena Safati's fiance, who was called up, many Jewish soldiers, and they went tromping off to Albania, and they started to beat the Italian army. Hitler had a conniption, because even though Mussolini did it against his wishes, he could not be embarrassed in that way. So Hitler then decided that he had to move in, and because Salonika is in the north, it was the first city, and it became the major conquest that they had for the first few years. And in April 9th of 1941, he came in, invaded. And this created a huge mess because they were obviously stronger than the Greek army. The Greeks have to retreat. And they're marching through the town, and she and her, by this time, her father had died. Her older brother, Eli, was taking care of them. It was her grandmother and her great aunt, and I think they were five girls, but one of her sisters went to Palestine, and one of them went to Marseille. And since there were about three of them, I think, who were left in Salonika that Eli was taking care of, and they would see the POWs being marched back and forth. In the meantime, her fiancé reappears, and I'll talk about what happened with him in a minute, they're watching the soldiers that are being marched by, and then one day her sister notices that there's a British soldier who has a Magen David or a mezuzah or Magen David around his neck, and they flip out, at this poor Jewish soldier. What can we do? And one day when they're marching by, the sister grabs him into the house. She just pulls him into the house, and he is wounded. And they're taking care of him. They're trying to take care of him, and they take off his uniform. They put on other clothes, and they're nursing him in secret, and he dies. And they absolutely flip out. It was a mezuzah. He had fever. He was fever. And here I've written down the details that I've forgotten, that they were repairing a road. They saw someone with mezuzah. The sister brought her in, and the next day while they were walking, there was a fire. And so in the confusion, her sister felt that no one would notice if she pulled him in. She smuggled the soldier home while everybody else went walking, and she came home. They bathed him, they fed him, they put on cold compresses. The poor guy had malaria, he came and took the clothes. They didn't know. They burned. They debated burning the uniform. They weren't quite sure what to do with it. And the aunt keeps taking care of him. They gave him quinine, which was used for malaria, which again, her brother got the quinine on the black market using family gold for him. They got milk from the Red Cross so that they could take care of him, but unfortunately he dies, and her brother goes to the leader of the Jewish community, who was his friend, and says, what should I do? You know, what am I supposed to do with this guy? They were very careful. Now, there were already Jewish police who had been assigned by the Nazis, so they were very careful not to speak in the presence of the Jewish police. They gave him papers, two men came in and washed him, and they gave him a coffin and brought a carriage with to transport the coffin, and the four women pushed the carriage to the cemetery, and they left it there. For him to be buried, and they saved his mezuzah. They kept the mezuzah. She said the men said Kaddish for him, and they sort of sat shiva for this fellow there. So this was already how she and her family were just so involved in the Jewish world, and they didn't know who this guy was, but they just wanted to take care of him. She had been working. Buena volunteered for everything. She was working at the Soup Populaire, which was the soup house that they had, there were many, many poor in Salonika. There were people dying on the streets. There were many starving. And in the Soup Populaire, they were basically preparing milk for babies. And so the women from the poorer neighborhood, because Salonika had different neighborhoods, the women from the poorer neighborhood were allowed to come in certain hours, and Buena was with her friend Sarah in particular. She was in the building Matanot Le'Evyonim, which still exists. I actually went there and took all the photographs I took, except of Buena. you could see Matanot Le'Evyonim was where they were preparing the milk all the time, she had many, many encounters with the head of the Jewish police, who was a horrible human being named Vidal Chasson. And he was, he realized that she was someone who just didn't follow the rules and did what she thought was right. And I'll give you an example. His sister worked for the Jewish community. She was the one who was basically preparing all the lists of all the names of all the Jews for the Nazis. His brother set his eye on her best friend Sarah, who she was working with, and came and said that my brother wants to marry her. Buena said, "Do not marry them. This is a terrible family. He's stealing from the Jews. He's an awful person." And basically, Chasson said to her father, "If she doesn't marry my brother, you're all going to die." So he arranged for the wedding, and she describes the wedding. I mean, she's very, very, very unhappy. Sarah is crying through the entire wedding ceremony, and they've got a carriage and going through the city, the streets of Salonika, and quite miserable. And he realized that Buena was, you know, very far from being on his side. And one of the incidents that she had was when the women didn't show up at the Matanot Lavionim to get their milk, and she got very upset because she said, "How are these babies and children going to get milk? They're all suffering from malnutrition as it is." And she speaks to the head of the Red Cross, with whom she was working, and he said to her, "You know what? I'll send you with a Red Cross car, and I'll give you all the milk, and I'll send you over to the it was actually by that time it was a ghetto, to the neighborhood that was called Baron de Hirsch, to the Hirsch neighborhood, and that was where all the poor Jews were, and I'll send you over, and we'll take care of you." Unbeknownst to her, that was the day that the first deportations were planned. And as she rides in, she sees that all the barbed wire is up there on this neighborhood for the first time, and she sees all the guards. And she says to herself, "You know, I think I'm going to go in, but I don't think I'm going to ever get out." And she goes in, and Hassan comes over to her, and she's mixing the powder with the water. And he comes into her and he says, "This stuff is so good, let's see you drink it." And he starts pouring it down her throat. And she's vomiting all over the place, and her gums are bleeding because he's shoving the stuff into her face. And she's just like, she's standing there in total disbelief. She came to take care of the children. And then finally he says to her, "Okay, go ahead and give them what's left over." She does. And she also, it was interesting, she saw him talking to a commanding officer. She had, like I said, a phenomenal memory. Many years later, she's watching television with her son, and she sees Kurt Waldheim, and she says, "That's the man who was with Hassan at the camp with me." And he says, "Mom, you're nuts." She says, "You're crazy. You're absolutely crazy." And of course, later they discovered that he indeed was with the Gestapo. I mean, it was, you know, unbelievable. But she leaves, and she is frightened that Hassan is going to take revenge on her. And basically what happens is that some Greek friends come and say to her, "You better get out of here." And she goes to her fiance, to Chaim, and she says, "You know what? Let's get married tomorrow morning and out of here, because we can't travel together. It'll be inappropriate if we're not married." And she doesn't sleep at home. She stays at Greek friend's house. And they had arranged in the morning, very early in the morning, to have their wedding. And when she got there, her fiancé was shot dead. And she's taken prisoner. She's taken prisoner by the Nazis. I'm going to back up a little bit here, because among the other, I mean, that led her working at the Souk Populaire led to this. She also, there were on what was called, it was called their Black Sabbath, they had asked all of the Jewish men to come to the square. Today it's right near the water, right near the, in the center of town. It's a parking lot, and there's a little sign there saying that this is where it was, but they're planning now on changing it and making it a more serious memorial. And the first time the Jews it's in July, it's hot as anything, and a very small number show up, and they're furious, and they beat the ones who show up, and then they said, you know, come the next day and whatnot, and they send them out to forced labor camps. Well, because she was affiliated with the Red Cross, she was the representative who was allowed to go and visit them and check on them. First I'll go back here. You can see the second copla. The copla is this kind of verses that she wrote. Papa Naum was the Greek leader, and here it's Chasson, who was the head of the Jewish police. He became friendly with Papa Naum. So Papa Naum se hizo amigo con Chasson. Todos dicen que tiene este antisemit con un judío. Están haciendo en juntos los planos por la deportación de los judíos y tomar todos los bienes de los desmazalados. By the way, you can hear where the Hebrew, you know, like any Jewish language, like Judeo-Arabic, and this is Judeo-Spanish, so antisemit, judío, here, desmazal. They take, in Ladino, mazal, they take it, and des is unfortunate. Mazal is someone's fortunate. Desmazalado is an unfortunate person. Esperanos que no van a parvenir, porque Salónica es a ciudad de Nes. Bebamos a la salud de aquellos que creen que vamos a vivir. Papa Naum befriended Chasson. Everyone says, what is this anti-Semite doing with a Jew? They are making plans together for the deportation of the Jews and to take all the belongings of these unfortunates. Obviously, this she has in hindsight. She's able to say what had happened. We hope that they are not going to succeed because Salonika is a city of miracles. Let us drink to the health of those who believe that we are going to live, which was unfortunately not true. And also she has about, it's interesting as to how the Greeks, she mentions Greek friends. She mentions the fact that she hid with Greek friends. She mentions also that her brother left things with Greek friends, and some of them took what? He left a bank account. The banker said, no, he didn't leave anything. There was the banker's wife who was carrying her mother's purse. When she saw it, and the banker says, give that back to her. I mean, that's all she got back from him. There were some Greek friends who were wonderful and some Greek friends who were less wonderful. But she writes, amigos griegos nos quieren ayudar, se espantan, ma inemos vienen a visitar, demanden si queréis que hayamos alguna cosa, ma nosotros somos espantosos. Bebamos a la salud de estos amigos que no mancaron de mos encorajar. Greek friends want to help us. They are afraid, but even so, they come to visit us. They ask us if we need anything, but we are fearful. Let us drink to the health of those friends who never fail to encourage us. I'll also point out that the older generation did not know Greek. And one of the reasons, there were many reasons why so few of the young people left. Very, very few joined the partisans. Very, very few left. Some of them went to the countryside and hid, but they wouldn't. One, they didn't want to leave their families because the family was the ultimate value for these young people. Two, most of them didn't speak Greek. Some of the younger generation did, but the older generation only spoke Ladino, and those who had gone to the Allianz schools spoke the French as well. Also, Salonika is way up in the mountains in the north, and it was quite a trek to get anywhere else, like to go down to Athens. You wouldn't walk there. You'd have to take a train. It was quite a trek. And they didn't have contacts with those. This was the largest Jewish community. This was a community that had, you know, 65,000 Jews in it, with maybe 10 or 12 in Athens. I mean, it's a huge, huge Jewish community. And everybody spoke Ladino, and so on. I guess the baby doesn't like my voice. And then she writes an interesting comment in 14, parecemos unos codredos en frente de los alemanos. We appear to be like sheep facing the Germans. Now, this is obviously something from post-Holocaust that they always talked about, going like, you know, kitzon de teva, but they did not see themselves that way then. La juventud se quiere revoltar, mas la calle de Salónica es de asfalto. The youth ought to revolt, but the street of Salónica is of asphalt. non hay ni piedras para orejar. There were no stones to throw. Bebamos a la salud de Avram Yonatan. Let us drink to the health of Avram Yonatan. And then the next two are about her visits with her working, going to the work camps. Fue a visitar a los mancebos. I went to visit the young men. Que los alemanes tomaron a lavoro forzados, whom the Germans took for forced labor. De 18 a 28, todo judío debía ir. Every Jew aged 18 to 28 had to go. Como laboraba a la Croix Rouge, tenía carta para entrar. Being a worker for the Red Cross, I had an entrance pass. Los mancebos estaban comiendo lana bullida con agua. The fellows were eating cabbage boiled in water. Gosti no había ni sal. It had neither taste nor salt. Bebamos a la salud de estos mancebos que están sufriendo sin quedar. Let us drink to the health of these young men who are suffering without complaining. She wrote many verses about this experience because it was very, very traumatic for her. And you could see she discusses it in number 25. Cuando vine en casa de las ergas, when I came home from the labor camp, o lavoro forzado, which is forced labor, estaba muerta cansada, I was dead tired, de ver estos mancebos sufriendo, after seeing those young men suffering. En a tornada, mi casa estaba llena de madres. When on my return, my house was filled with mothers. A demandar si vide a su hijo y cómo está. Each one asking if I saw her son and how he is. A todos le dice que están buenos. I told them all that they are fine. She just lied. She just couldn't bear to tell them they were starving to death. But el corazón me duelo de ver estos mancebos en dolor. My heart ached to see these fellows in pain. Bebamos a la salud de estos mancebos que estaban sin color. Let us drink to the health of those young men who had no color in their faces. You know, so she was really the only person who actually wrote about these things. Nobody else survived here.
You're saying she wrote this afterwards.
She wrote this afterwards.
And yet you can feel as if she's right there.
Oh, yeah.
You can see it.
Yeah, she relived it. She relived it when she wrote it and translated it and then wrote her memoirs and, you know, and whatnot. And, you know, this was before they brought survivors to schools to talk and the idea of bringing some Sephardi, which, you know, they didn't, you know, realize it. You know, there's the famous story of Yitzhak Navon about in the Shuk in Machane Yehuda of the fish seller. The Ashkenazi's buying fish from him, and he reaches to get the fish, and the Ashkenazi sees the fish seller with a number on his arm, and he says, "What are you doing with a number on your arm?" And he said, "I lost my whole family in Auschwitz. I'm from Salonika." You know, I mean, there was this lack of awareness of the loss of the Sephardim. It was much smaller numerically, but it, certainly for the Greek Jewry and Yugoslavian Jewry, it was no, and the Jews in Crete, the Jews in Rhodes, it was no less devastating whatsoever. She also had, I should say that later on when I reread some of her material, I see that I wasn't able to pick up on every single aspect of her entire life. And for example, she mentions at one point that she went to the chief rabbi and she said, "Look, this is not good. What's going on is not good. I have Greek friends on the other side. Let me bring the babies to them. Let me bring babies to them, because whatever happens, babies aren't going to survive what's going on." And he refused. And she, despite that, smuggled out a few babies over to Greek friends. And after the war, she goes back and she finds one in a monastery. And the little girl is completely traumatized, doesn't recognize her, like, she brings her candy and she tries to win her over, and they say to her, you know, if you can have her if she's willing to go. And she comes back many, many times. She takes her out to feed her in a restaurant. She's crossing herself. Buena's having conniptions. And she finally agrees, and she takes her to Palestine and finds family to take care of this little girl. there, and she writes in depth, you know, about that. She is taken to the prison camp Pavlomela, which actually, this is rather ironic, but 3 years ago, I had never been to Salonika. I wanted to go. There was a European Biblical Association conference in Salonika, and I knew the organizer, and I said, you know, would you like me to come and talk a bit about the history of the Jews of Salonika, because you're coming in and you're studying Bible and you don't know where you are, and there's next to no Jewish community left, and I think that that would be a pity. And she said, fine. So I gave the opening talk, and then I was able to go around taking pictures and just didn't have to attend any sessions. But ironically, I gave the opening talk a few hours before Erev Tisha B'Av. And I had contacted the rabbi there, who was actually a rabbi from Shoham, a Moroccan rabbi from Shoham, who was serving there. And I said to him, you know, where's Echa? What's going on? And he said, well, most everybody goes on vacation during the summer because it's too hot here. But we have, and the one synagogue that they use during the year was not there before. It's inside a building. You'd never know that there was a synagogue there. Only one synagogue survived the Holocaust out of about 40 because it was used as a storehouse. So that's the one where they'll use for sometimes weddings or high holidays. But I don't have a minyan. I said, I don't have a minyan because everybody goes away and I have such a small community. So I immediately started sending emails to these Bible scholars and saying, you know, who's interested in going to Echa? And we went back, arranged for a meal. As we walked out, the Bible Association had, I will never forget this, Erev Tisha B'Av roast pork. And we just quickly went back to our hotel. Chabad brought us a meal. And I arranged for 4 taxi cabs to take us to the shul. And the rabbi is in tears. And I brought 16 men and 12 women. And he said, I'm not supposed to be happy. You know, it's Tisha B'Av. I'm so happy. You know, he had, so that was my Tisha B'Av. I just remember 3 years ago in Salonika. Yeah.
I can just make a comment. We were there last summer. And on Friday, we had taken a tour. And we were taken to the shul, which looks like a business building. It's a shul. And I said to my husband, how are we going to find this tomorrow when we're all walking, because we're all going to leave from the hotel at different times?
There's a guard.
There was a guard. That's what I wanted to call it.
Yeah.
There was a guard standing outside because it's a shul and it's Shabbat and they were worried about...
And it's Europe. Every European shul has a guard outside.
I was in Washington recently. That's how I found the shul.
I just remembered that I was there three years ago on Tisha B'Av, and during the day a fellow who I'd been in touch with, whose father had been the head of the community, had come to my talk, and then he said, you know, can I help you? And I said, you know what, if you would take me around in a car on Tisha B'Av, because it was 95 degrees, and two colleagues of mine, one whose father was from Salonika, who's at Hebrew University here, we got in the car, and he took us to the various places that we went to again, and all of a sudden, I realized that we were in front of the prison where she had been, in front of Pavlomela, and it was an army prison, and it said, no photographs. Well, I took a picture. I said, let him arrest me. It was actually, the battery died right after that picture, but I took a picture of Pablo Melas, and when she got there, there was a female prison guard taking care of her, who was a German woman but actually knew some Greek, so she was able to talk to her. And I mean, it was she was interrogated day and night, just day and night, because also later she mentions that. During a later trip, they take her back to Pavlomela and to the room where she'd been interrogated, and she's like about to pass out because she can't bear being in there. And she said 4 or 5 times a day, they were sure that she was a partisan, And she wasn't. She had just been, you know, a rebel by nature who wasn't afraid of Chasson and was doing things that they didn't know about, but the fact that she took on Chasson and he had marked her. And they were asking her, where are the partisans? Who is the chief? Where are the headquarters in Salonika? Who is the boss? And they stood her against the wall. They whipped her on her feet when she didn't answer questions. Who were the saboteurs? Who were the underground members? And her guard would try to encourage her to talk and would bring her soup. Now, what she did was incredibly smart. She kept thinking, I've got to let somebody know where I am. How can I let somebody know where I am? So she says to the guard, you know, there's a shop that has the most beautiful blouses you could imagine. While you're in Salonika, you really should get it. The craftsmanship is amazing. And she kept talking to her about it and talking to her about it. And eventually this gal's curiosity is piqued. And she goes to the shop and asks for it. And this German guard asking, they realize they put two and two together. And let the underground know that Buena is there and that they have to break her out. So they had stolen some German officers' outfits. And one superior officer, she called him, said he was coming to interrogate her. He drugged the guard. He gave the guard's clothes to Buena so that she could escape. And they walked out as Germans. She went to her house. She grabbed some clothing. They could make a movie out of Buena's life. I should tell you that Buena's son swears that the time he went to Greece, he was talking to a cab driver. And we know that her name, once she did join the partisans, was not Buena Sarfati, but Maritza Serefamidu. And he said, you know, my mother was in the partisans. She was Maritza Serefamidu. And he said, there's a movie made about her by the educational television. I have tried through the consulate, through the television, everybody to get a hold of it. Nobody can find it. We don't have a year. We don't know what. But this cab driver swore that he had seen a story of his mother on the television. And she went and got and she said, how's she going to leave? Her father had a very, very good friend who was Italian, Daniel Modiano, who had lots of connections. And Modiano, the Italian consul in Salonika actually helped many Jews get false papers. If you were married to an Italian, he got for the spouse, and he also got for Buena. He got her an ID called he called her Flora Tivoli, gave her a nice Italian name, and she actually, he doesn't want her to leave yet. She goes off to the mountains and is hiding out in different villages, and she writes about this, and she has experience after experience, and she goes into one, she works in one soup kitchen, and they're all Catholics, and they're all crossing each other, and this woman pulls her aside and takes her in the kitchen and says, let me teach you how to do it right, because she was doing it backwards, you know, there. I mean, she didn't know what she was doing, but she has... She takes a couple of months until Danielle tells her that she can now leave, and she goes to the house. She had an ID card. She had papers to go to Athens, and could take one valise with her. What's really weird was that she, when she got to the station in Salonika, Chasson was standing there checking to see who was getting on. And she stood there and she writes a verse about it, which I didn't include because it's sort of vulgar. And the first time I read it, I wasn't sure I understood it. And I wrote to my dear friend, Aaron Rodrigue, who's a native Ladino speaker at Stanford University. And I said, Aaron, does this mean what I think it means? And he said, yes. She said she nearly in her pants. And I said, oh my God. And she said that her friends were there with weapons, and that if Hasson had done anything, they would have shot him on the spot, and that's why he did not. She went with a veil. She got on with a, you know, like a good Greek woman, Italian widow or something, and got on with a black veil. But she gets onto the train. She goes. The train does not go all the way to Athens. It goes until where the Italians were allowed to go. Lets them off in the middle of a forest somewhere. Then they have some other people meet them, and they get some other local transportation. And she gets into Athens, and she joins up with the partisans. And she has a zillion accounts about her experience with the partisans. I mean, she works and identifies information on a boat. She talks about how she went to a cafe and she was to meet someone, and she decided to go dressed as a sort of an old Greek lady and barefoot. And there was a roundup, and they took everybody but her because she was barefoot, and they just didn't believe that anybody would, you know, that she was clearly some old Greek lady, you know, there, and saved her life. And again, she has all of these stories where they hide out in a storehouse, and she had to go to the bathroom, and she took her cohort with her, and the Germans attack and burn their barn while she's out in the outhouse, you know, I mean, just, and survives, or how she's walking along and she hears a baby crying and she sees a dead woman and a baby lying there, and she picks up the baby, and there was attached to the baby was a purse with some jewels, and she takes this baby, and this is the baby that identifies her when she comes to Palestine, who there. And then even afterwards, she finds out that when she gets to Palestine, that the uncle sends her, asks where did you find my sister? And she tells him exactly, and he finds that she'd hidden something underneath there, and he finds it had never been touched, that she'd left gold for her child, you know, in case she died. And she wasn't shot, she had died of malaria or something. About the prison, what happens is that the fellow who had saved her, according to Buena, took too many chances because his German was very good and he was going around. And her prison guard, recognized him in the street and identified him and killed him on the street, killed the fellow who had saved her. She said, cut open his back and put salt in. And he wanted to know who the storekeeper was, and he said that he died in great pain, but he did not reveal the name of the storekeeper or where Buena was. Here I had some others on the next page. It also has to do with one of the boys that was in the work camp. So she said, the first one I saw at the camp was Solomon Shaki. Blood was running down his nose. He did not have a handkerchief to wipe himself clean. I gave him mine, which did not suffice. And here, there was a typical, I was reading it, and it goes, you know, el primo que vide a las ergas fue Solomon Shaki. La estaba corriendo sangre de la nariz. No tenía risa para se la limpiar. La mía con que no bastó. Araski el volan, and I had no idea what a volan was. I didn't know what she gave him. And then it turns out it's French for a petticoat. I mean, I knew French, but I'd never learned petticoat when I studied the history of the Jews in France. You know, I tore the petticoat of my dress. Y se lo di, continui mi viejita, que el amán me dicho que avanzar, por seguro que esta escena nunca me la voy a olvidar. I continued my visit since the German told me to move on. There is no doubt that I will never forget that scene. Let us drink to the health of those who are going to survive. Then she talks a lot about the fear of the Jewish police and about how horribly they treated their fellow Jews, and how they, especially Hasson, was robbing and raping and stealing and beating unbelievably, and so were his cohorts. And she says, todos se espanten de hablar, parece que haya Politofilaca sin brazar, la sola cosa que dicen, boca cerrada, no entra mosca, bebamos a la salud que aquellos que hicieron la boca. Everyone's afraid to talk. There seem to be Jewish police everywhere. The only thing they say is, and this is a classic Ladino proverb, flies don't enter closed mouths. Let us drink to the health of those who close their mouths. And she also talks about this when she gets to Athens. She doesn't know who to trust. She's petrified. She absolutely has no idea to trust. And then we get here to one of the big problems of the image of the rabbi. The rabbi, the chief rabbi in Salonika, was Rabbi Koretz. He had been brought in a few years before the war by the young people who decided they wanted a modern rabbi. And since the Sephardi Chachamim were antiquated, old guys, you know, they didn't want them. They wanted somebody modern. So they look around, and they bring in a Polish rabbi who had been educated in Germany and come in, and the old school is furious, and they say to him, we give you 4 months or 6 months to learn Greek and Ladino, otherwise you're out. And the poor guy has to like break his neck to learn Greek and Ladino and to see if he can manage. But he never won over the hearts of the community. And after the war, everybody blamed him. Because he spoke German, he really felt that you have to do everything they say and do it as fast as you can, as efficiently as you can, because he thought that was the best way to do it. And there's a huge debate, and there are lots of academic articles that have been written about the mindset of the Salonikan survivors as to whether Rabbi Koretz was really as awful as they say he was, or was he just their scapegoat? Just last week I got my colleague in Salonika, Irina Molcho, writes a lot about it, and she did, you know, 70 years in perspective, 60 years retrospect, and somebody translated into Hebrew from the Greek, and it's a big problem, because those who came to Israel, you know, blamed him. They said it was part of the post-Zionist, you know, kind of approach to it and all. On the other hand, I have things like Buena saying, I went to him and asked him, could I say babies? And he says no. So I'm caught, you know, there's so much that you can blame him for, obviously. But he had also been sent, he went to Athens to, without the permission of the Germans, he went there to speak to the head of the German of the Greek community to see if they could help, and they punished him by sending him off to Vienna for 6 months. And he came back saying, everything's going to be fine. So there's this, wait a minute, you're in Vienna, you know, all the Jews have been already sent out, how could everything be fine? So it's really a major problem And so she wrote here, Koretz nos vendió a toda la judería para se salvar él y su familia y toda su compañía. Hemos dicho que él viene de venir de la Europa y todos los judíos comen bien y no la babota. Bebamos a la salud de Daniel Serota. She says, Koretz sold us out. This was the feeling. The whole Jewish community in order to save himself. Now, I don't believe that. He didn't do it to save himself. He did it because he thought that if he was efficient and did what he said, that they wouldn't be punished. What happened to him, and it says family and his entourage, he was in Bergen-Belsen. He, his wife, and his son were in Bergen-Belsen. He died, like the last week, he died of a disease in Bergen-Belsen. His wife, the widow, and Gita, and his son came back to Salonika, and they were put up in some professor's apartment, where all the others who had survived had terrible accommodations. So also, you know, it was, and they didn't, and the son came to Israel, the son and the wife came to Israel. I have a copy of her testimony at Yad Vashem. And of course, she felt, I didn't know why we were being treated so terribly. My husband did everything for the community, you know, and it's a serious problem. I mean, the son, about 10 years ago, I think he was about 60, had a bar mitzvah here because he had never had a bar mitzvah for the year. So he's a retired lawyer in Tel Aviv, his son, you know. But, it was a serious, serious problem because of how they ended up getting going to a better place, getting better treatment. And he didn't do it for that. He got it because he was the leader of the community. But there was just, you know, a very, very, there still are very, very bitter feeling, very, very bitter feelings about it. And I leave it at that. I don't want to, you know, to judge. But what I can judge Chasson. This him, I have no problem, whatsoever, because there's nobody who. Here we, I mentioned that it's La Hermana de Chasson es empleada de la comunidad. Her sister is an employee of the community. Sabe todos los secretos de la judería. She knows all the secrets of the Jewish community. Se los dio a Chasson para su culebrería. She gave them to Chasson for his, and this was a tough word to figure out, for his low-down snake-like, a culebra is a snake, snake-like business. El tiempo de la deportación se hinchó de oro que el hermano arrobó. At the time of the deportation, she stuffed herself with gold that her brother stole. Chasson la mandó con los privilegiados y a Salónica atornó. Chasson sent her with the privilege and she returned to Salónica. Estuvo juzgada. She was tried. Mal horosamente. Non había testimonios para la condenar. Unfortunately, there were no witnesses to condemn her. Todos se murieron al crematorio de Alman. They had all died in the German crematorium. But I will tell you, the Daniel Modiano, whom I mentioned, the Italian father friend who saved her, he went to Italy. He went with his family and about three or four other Italian families, because they had been helping to stay away. And if you look at 97, and this is also, I read about this in a number of books about the Holocaust, La suerte de Daniel Modiano fue una tragedia. The fate of Daniel Modiano was a tragedy. Estaba en Italia en un hotel a Lac Superior. In a hotel on Lake Superior. Los alemanes vinieron, mataron a él y a su compañía. Los cadáveres fueron echados al lac. And this was, I read about it in a number of books, of how there was an attack of a group of Jewish family, of Jewish families, Italian families, and someone had informed on them, and they shot them all and threw them into the lake. And this is how the man who saved her, and she writes, esto hizo al el Amán más negro de Faro y Amán. So you see, it doesn't have the H. It's missing in the Ladino. This was done by the German more evil than Pharaoh and Haman. The one that I skipped over was the one that 77, where she says, we're in Athens, salimos a mercar cena, we go out to eat dinner, vemos amigos y conocidos, we see friends or acquaintances. Non decimos ni shalom ni buenos días. We don't say hello or good day. Non sabemos si es puro judío. We don't know if this person is a loyal and pure Jew. O politofilaca de alemán, or a German collaborator. Bebamos a la salud de los que toman precaución. We let us drink to those, the health of those who take precautions. So she always went, you know, looking behind her. I mentioned, yeah, Sharon.
Can you say something about her poetry style? Because I see some of this really seems to actually rhyme, and if you read the Ladino, and others just seems to be much more of a...
Yeah, well, she had poetic license. She tried to, she tries for five lines, which is the copla. The coplas originally were rabbinic kind of poetry. And then in the end of the 19th century, it became more popular. And matter of fact, she has an entire, she writes about 10 coplas about coplas, in about how dad comes home from work and mom's busy preparing dinner and he tosses out a copla to make her smile, you know, and so that it became sort of like, I sort of like a limerick, like a little thingy, a little ditty or something. Some of hers are really nicely rhymed. Others, she just wanted to get her point across. So when I gave a talk with Shmuel Rafael, and he as a literature person, he said, you know, Dante, she is not. You know, Whitman, she is not. But what she has to say nobody else said and nobody else survived to say. So it's sort of, again, she's not the greatest poet, but she tried to. She tried to, and when she felt she had to, she made them longer, she added a little more. It was her idea to put the last line, you know, we drink to the health of so-and-so there. After the war, I mentioned she comes back. She comes back and she's working with UNRWA and with the trying to convince them to go to deportation. She's at a DP camp, in northern Greece, mostly Bergen-Belsen survivors, and she has it's a very, very difficult experience. She says they're extremely bitter. This is one part I could not figure out, and I wish she had survived for me to talk to her about it, because she was the only Sephardi there. She was the only Ladino speaker. There were lots of non-Jews there. There were lots of people that were not particularly nice, not nice to her and not nice to the deportees. And I didn't understand why they didn't weren't so happy to have someone who could understand them, who could talk to them. But I don't know whether they were just so traumatized that they couldn't separate out. But she talks about how bitter they are. And then she says, finally, when they have the akshara, you know, they getting ready to go to Palestine, they start seeing they have a purpose in life, and they start cheering up there. She works there for a number of months. We actually have son gave me photocopies of all her the slips she has in recognition of her service and so on. And then she goes back to Salonika, and it's a tough, tough visit, tough. And she sees this young girl, they said, wearing a jacket that she had, her mother had embroidered. She actually finds the address of this, and it's the owner has a wealthy farmer, and she goes with her. And then Max, she becomes Buena Safati Garfinkel, with Max Garfinkel. And they go there, and as they approach, the farmer's wife comes out, sees her, realizes what's going on, and sticks the dog on them. And Buena answers her back. The husband appears and pulls the dog aside, and basically says, let her in. She comes in and she sees a cushion there, and Buena said, I made that. And the woman says, no, I made that. And she's looking, she says, you're absolutely lying. And then she sees around work of art that were made by her and her sisters, ashtrays, a table, lamps, candy dishes of silver, the engagement gift that she'd gotten from her friend Sarah, china from her fiancé's aunt, a sofa with two seats and four chairs. And it turns out that her brother had stored them there when they had moved. They moved during the ghetto when they kept reorganizing the Jews. They kept moving them from neighborhood to neighborhood, and when they moved. And then the husband goes upstairs and brings down a huge trunk, and in it was all of her trousseau, which I have she has a whole series of coplas about the trousseau and how all the girls made sat on the balcony and sewed everything from handkerchiefs to underwear to sheets, and how they would take how they would dry out all of the goose feathers for the mattresses, and they'd have a party in the courtyard. And she describes all the Sephardi customs that they did. And she said, and there is, they bring it down, and there was and wool that they would dry out, stuff them sometimes with feathers and sometimes with wool, because there was a big industry of sheep, which actually the Jews were dealt in Salonika. And she said they brought down a special wood and a bundle of her wool, enough for three mattresses there, that she said, when I was 15, we boiled the water, we washed the wool, and she even recorded all the songs that they sang. And she said it almost took the entire summer for the wool to dry. And then she got some of the stuff. She went in this room and she was incredibly depressed. And she You know, she's while she's there, she's trying to sing, she's trying to make herself feel better, she's trying to figure out what she can do and you know what she can take and what she can't take. She goes to buy some chestnuts from a street vendor, and he gives it to her wrapped in paper, and she opens it up, and it's pages from her mother's Haggadah. I mean, she's just flipping out the whole time that she's there. It's such a difficult, difficult trip to do. She marries Max in the one remaining synagogue that's still there. They have a wedding. It's very, very tiny wedding. What happens also is very interesting that there were some young people who had hidden in the mountains, and a few had survived. They came back, and they were absolutely shocked to see that there's nobody there. There's no family. There were a few girls who had been raped by Russian soldiers and were pregnant, and they were like all at a loss. One of the rabbis, Rabbi Molcho, who had actually documented the cemetery before it was totally this was the other thing. The Greeks had set their eyes on the cemetery. The cemetery was from pre-1492, and right by the center of town, because the Jews lived in the center of town, and the cemetery was in the border. But as the city got larger there, you know, they wanted to expand, and the university wanted that property. And they offered it to buy it, and the Jews said, nothing doing. And then when the Nazis came in, they were talking about forced labor, and then they went to the rabbi and they said, well, we won't do this and that, or we want X amount of money from you. If you give us the cemetery, we won't charge you 5 million drachmas. And Molcho, and Akurat says, okay. And they come in and they just smash all of the matzevot. And today you can still find them. They were used for swimming pool because of marble, for urinals. For when I was there, my colleague and I actually found one in a church courtyard, and I wrote to my colleague who was active in this community, and through the city he would manage to get that matzeva out into the Jewish cemetery. You know, this was also another reason that they had so much anger towards the rabbi, that they felt he sold them out. At any rate, they come out and she goes to the rabbi and they talk, and what are we going to do? There are all these young people and they need to continue their lives. And Rabbi Molcho and she decide that they're going to have a group wedding, that this is the best way. We'll all be each other's family, and if we have 15 couples, then we'll all be there for each other. And the joint, they turn to the joint comes in, and the joint sends the material. Buena starts sewing dresses because she's a seamstress, and there's a big fight with the community, because there are those of them saying they're doing this for propaganda and they want to take pictures and show them we're fine, and they walk out on her, and she ends up baking the cakes on her own and doing everything on her own. And in this, there are pictures. There were a couple of other weddings, like three weddings like this. If you ever go to Salonika, and to the Jewish Museum there, which is a lovely, small but lovely museum, when I was there and I was walking with my friend, and I said, and at the very, very end, there's a picture of this communal wedding. And I said, Bueno is here. And I look, and I see a lot of brides. And I walk away. And I walk back again. And I go, gee, Bueno is here. And I walk away, and I go back again, and then all of a sudden, smack in the middle, I see one woman, not in a bridal outfit, with a corsage on. And I had met Buena's son, he had come to Israel, and I'd met him, and I saw the same eyes. And I go into the head of the museum, and I said, you must give me a copy of this picture. It's in the book, it's in some other books as well. And I said, and I sent it to her son, and he said, I wouldn't have recognized her. I said, Eli, you have your mother's eyes. She was just staring at me. It was just totally uncanny. I will just end with another post-Holocaust event, which was Hassan fled to Albania he took a limousine, he took his wife, he took his mistress. I mean, we're talking chutzpah. I mean, this guy was unbelievable. And he gets picked up. he is identified by someone, and then he's sent in, and they don't think he's serious enough, and then he goes to Egypt, and someone else identifies him, and he finally is arrested, and he's put on trial. Buena attends this trial, but she got dizzy and fainted, so she couldn't testify. She just said there were just too many traumatic memories. He tried to escape to Albania. The Italian consul in Salonika gave him the escape vehicle, they were sent to Athens. He went with his wife, mistress, and son, arrested at the border by the Italians, put in an Albanian concentration camp, liberated in 43, took the valuables, went to Bari, from there to Egypt by a fishing boat, circulated in Alexandria, was recognized by a refugee, arrested by the British police, sent to Athens and then to Haidari when Greece was liberated. He was not sent to trial, but he was set free, but returned in November 45 and recognized by survivors. He was sent to Pavlomela by Greek authorities. They also arrested two of his helpers in the Yugoslavian frontier. The trial was in July 2nd, 1946, she said, at 10 in the morning. He was accused of helping Germans deport Jews to Poland, acts of violence, complicity, carrying weapons, collaboration with the Germans against the Greek Jews, robbing them, mistreating non-Jews, Greeks who helped Jews, brutalizing men as women. And he said he was as powerful as the chief of the ghetto, and he shared the loot with the SS director there. He had limos and went to the suburbs and found Jews hiding. He beat and robbed them. And there was a witness there who was able to talk about the fact that he had 7 family members hiding, and Hassan killed them all and looted all their possessions. Hassan, 5 days of hearings. He was sentenced to death at 3 o'clock in the morning. And that, at least for her, was just some kind of closure there. So that's what I'm able to give you in an hour and a half about this woman's amazing, in my opinion, amazing life. It was an honor that I actually had met her and was able at least to keep her alive through my book. Yeah.